This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 2nd of February 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 173rd edition of Culture, with me, Robert Bound. Today, at the David Zwerner Gallery, I meet Luc Tuymans, the Belgian artist credited with rebooting painting itself.
The very first idea here was to do something about gardening, because the British like their gardens. But in a weird way, this wallpaper sort of like took care of that.
Is this a bit of an up yours, or is this just a...
Yeah, indirectly, yeah.
Ahead of a new show at the Soho Theatre, comedian Nick Mohammed channels his strange alter ego for us.
It was initially based on an impression of a teacher, and, you know, he's quite northern and quite sort of dismissive and quite nasal and just annoyed at lots of things.
Plus, we'll investigate the world of Christian Markley, who's making and breaking records literally at the White Cube Gallery. We'll get a roundup, or is it a rundown, of last week's Sundance Film Festival, and we'll go to a clown convention that I was too frightened to attend personally. That's all to come here on Culture, with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. First of all, let me introduce this week's Midori House session from Montreal's Bar Brothers, who released their second album, Sleeping Operator, last October, and are currently touring all over the place. They were here at Monocle HQ last week, though, to perform wonderful songs like Love Ain't Enough.
Just forget I ever said that it's true love ain't enough. Got a diamond in my head and a universal blood. Gotta find a better glue hold this picture of the sun. You've got to find a way to use before all of this is done. Once you strip the paint, you'll find it everywhere you go. You and I should know. Love is enough, love is enough, love is enough. Love is enough, love is enough, love is enough. Yeah, love is enough. The end of the track when the white flag waves and the heart attacks. Love is enough when you don't look back. My country is a cross, and my city is a vice, and so perilous place. For such a blood begotten price, just forget I ever said. It's true love ain't enough. Is a killer in my bed. you strip the paint, you'll find it everywhere you go. You and I should know. Everything that we esteem forever or a day, don't drive my love away. Love is enough, love is enough, love is enough. Love is enough, love is enough. Love is enough, the end of the track when the car wrecks and the heart attacks. Love is enough and you don't look back. Yeah, love is enough when you don't look back. Love is enough, love is enough, love is enough. Love is enough and you don't look back.
That was the Barr Brothers with Love Ain't Enough, and we'll have more music and a chat with the lead singer later on. For the first half of today's show, we're staying put in London to give you a taste of a couple of exhibition openings at two big-name galleries. First, we'll head to Mayfair and the David Zwerner Gallery for the new show by the Belgian painter Luc Toymans. Toymans was credited with breathing new life into painting in the 1990s, that decade strewn with installations, multiples and things in tanks. His new show, The Shore, is concerned with darkness and light, both really and metaphorically. Toymans paints Scottish Enlightenment thinkers. The title is taken from a painting of a scene from an old war movie. Toymans also paints a supposed celebrity cannibal, and he paints his hotel wallpaper and his bedroom lamp. Luc Toymans gave me a tour to let the light in. Or maybe it's the dark.
The whole show originated in a sense, like organically, to say so. I'm doing a big project in the Talbot Rice Gallery in the University of Edinburgh in November. And in the run-up to that, I went there and a couple of times, and I saw in the, they have a professor room, and they have all these paintings of Henry Rayburn. Now, I just, with my iPhone, took some photographs, and then I actually printed them out and took another photograph, which was like more close-up to the face. And I was quite astonished to see that they look extremely real. And that they also actually look contemporary, although they don't, they're not to be retraced to their time. By printing them out, there was also the element of a blue hue that came into the white, which you actually see more when you go standing right to the wall and you sort of align the paintings, and which is an element of abstraction that comes out of it. Anyway, the space downstairs, I wanted to make something that is, on the one hand, deals with status, on the other hand, is assuring. Upstairs, it becomes more disquieted.
Maybe we can go around the corner.
Yeah.
If we can talk in terms of cozy, we've got
a fireplace,
and we've got some of the wallpaper details.
And then we have two elements of wallpaper, which come from the hotel where I stayed, the Balmoral, in Edinburgh. So you have this one cloud, which looks like a croissant.
Or a high-speed snail.
Yeah, yes, really, which was pretty interesting. I mean, because there is the element of the idyllic, but it's printed on a wallpaper. Made for the space, I'm not really sure. The other one shows a sort of crooked obelisk, which is, of course, always a phallic element. And because the very first idea here was to do something about gardening, because the British like their gardens. But in a weird way, this wallpaper sort of like took care of that.
Is this a bit of an up yours, or is this just a...
Yeah, indirectly, yeah.
What's this painting called with the wallpaper painting with the obelisk?
Wallpaper.
It's called...
Wallpaper.
We'll read into that what we will. And then now we're looking
at the fireplace is a bit more complicated. Yeah. It's actually also a bit more emotional than you'd think. This is actually derived from a part of an installation of Mike Kelly, who was a friend of mine, and who, as you know, I mean, is it 1 or 2 years ago, maybe 1 year ago, killed himself, which was quite shocking for myself, because I never thought a person like Mike Kelly would do that. But he did it in a way that he was really sure that he was really going to be dead, basically. So this is sort of a homage to Mike Kelly. And in his, he made an installation where he painted on a cardboard box this fireplace, and there's a sort of string coming out which runs into the portrait of that he also painted of Abraham Lincoln. It's a very old installation.
Yeah. We'll go and find the more disquieting stuff, as promised, up the stairs here. I understand that they have to repaint the stairs because of the ladies' handbags scraping against the paintwork.
So here, there's one painting that should stay in London, which is
this is one. The Shore.
The Shore, which is also the title of the show. It's more an image that I sort of encountered. I was trying to entertain myself, trying to find some war movies on YouTube. And by accident, I stumbled upon a film which was made in 1968 called A Twist of Sand, which is not a great movie, but anyway. But the beginning of it is really strange. It's like a black image you get, and then you get the person that's sort of like a blob that emerges with a white flag, and then you get all these other people, and they get shot. So it's the image of an execution.
Which war is this?
That was actually the Second World War. This is also a very strange painting for me because I've, for a long time, wanted to paint a very dark painting, having been fascinated with the dark paintings of Goya, for example. And of course, Goya also made the May painting with the execution, of course. That sort of clung to me. It's a bit of a loner, and in that sense, I wanted to go to a museum because I think it's at its place there because it could have an iconic point. It's also some kind of a sign of the times in the sense that we are living interesting times. If you would do Arabic inscript, you would get Isis, you would get something quite clear. In a sense, it's graphic, basically. And it's also painted totally different than I usually paint because I painted the black first. I don't paint the hardest contrast in the first place. And it's also not black. I never use black. This is like indigo.
These are dark browns and reds.
Dark and greens and all that. And so that was really important to sort of make that twist as a twist of sand.
We've walked past a diorama painting, but I wanted to talk about this other foreboding presence down at the end of the room, Luke.
This is actually Mr. Hasegawa, which I've painted now 3 times. Yeah. I painted him as in his actual state, as he is, because he's still alive. I painted him probably right before he murdered the Dutch student in the Sorbonne, because he was studying in Paris, of which he ate some parts, because it was a story about cannibalism in 1974. And so this is actually comes out of a documentary about Mr. Hasegawa. And in the beginning of the documentary, they're actually trying to explain why he turned to cannibalism. His older brother, and he had his brother, another brother, which was like virtually his own age, a little bit younger. His older brother always threatened them both to put them in a pot with boiling water and to eat them. And that's so-called where the fascination would come from. But this is right before that is mentioned in the documentary, and you see him as a young kid with a mask and a tropical helmet.
And I can see one last painting that we can talk about, Luke. In the last room of the gallery here.
Yeah, this is actually my bedroom. This is what I wake up to in the morning, which is a unlit ball, which is a lamp in my room.
It looks a bit like a full moon, doesn't it?
It looks like a moon, it looks like a sphere. It's also built up in a way that it densifies itself in very small brushstrokes going to the violet and the purple in the middle, which embellishes it and gives it a sort of glow. But talking about enlightenment, the light is off.
That's a good, and we've gone full circle with our Scottish Enlightenment thinkers. We've gone through the heart of darkness and we come to an unlit light bulb.
Exactly.
And you wake up to this every morning. You've led us into your bedchamber and into your practice, I suppose. I'm interested in this one particularly because I wonder we've ended on it. Mm-hmm. We could have easily started on it and ended on the thinkers. But How did you think of the rhythm of this show?
The element of nothingness, you know, nothingness not in the philosophical sense, but in the true sense of nothing, which is, difficult. In that sense, I thought it was a proper end. It's also a circular thing, which is always giving you the idea of wholeness, of harmonious elements, but in this case, it's actually a giant disruption.
That was Luke Toyman speaking to me at the David Zwirner Gallery here in London, where you can catch his show, The Shore, until the 2nd of April. Now we're off to Bermondsey to meet the White Cube Gallery's latest resident, Christian Marclay. Marclay is best known for his Gold Lion-winning 2010 film, The Clock, a modern masterpiece that, 5 years on, still captivates gallery-goers worldwide. But how do you follow up such a hit? It's that tricky second record conundrum that Marclay's tackled, well, by making records. The current show features live performances which are recorded at the gallery and then pressed onto vinyl right before your very eyes. And Marclay's ongoing fascination with sound doesn't end at the music, with onomatopoeic paintings and animations that invite the audience to create soundscapes in their heads. It's a dizzying exhibition with a focus on liquids, from boozy nights out to the pouring of paint on a page. And over the weekend, producer Holly went along to find out how you make sound out of silence and water out of paper.
Entering London's White Cube Gallery is a bit like stumbling into the daylight after a night of dancing till dawn, and this is no accident. Along a wide corridor, disjointed and angular films of London streets on early Saturday mornings are projected onto the walls. As you pass through, your shadow casts across them, putting you on the street and making you feel a little jaded.
Pub Crawl is sort of a private performance. As I was walking down the streets with my little pen that I used to hit the glasses and my handheld camera. When you walk down the corridor, you feel a little bit drunk.
Pub Crawl is part of Christian Marclay's latest exhibition, which combines performance, animation, paintings, video and sound, all linked together by one particular theme. I meet Christian at the gallery.
Liquids is kind of the metaphor that connects all these different elements. So with the paintings referencing abstract expressionism, the liquidity of paint, the way it splatters and drips, approach these paintings as if I was performing a score. I made little collages using these appropriated comic book onomatopoeias, which I then collaged and blew up on these very large canvases.
One of the most successful parts of this exhibition is the way in which Marclay brings sound to life through silence. Surround sound is situated in a square room with floor-to-ceiling screens on all four walls. Onomatopoeic comic book words flash past, spiral around the room and blink at a mesmerised audience. Whoosh, beep, splat. There's no soundtrack to this, but the way the words appear is so well orchestrated that the interpretation in one's head is sonically rich. These are words that you want to get your mouth around, satisfying sounds to say.
So the challenge was to find the right movement with each sound. So I approached it very much the way I would compose a piece of music. I just collected all these sounds and then found ways to animate them. And then once I had all these fragments of animations, I kind of put the whole thing together into this silent composition. Everybody's, you know, reading them in their mind, not necessarily expressing them out loud, but this is a way to implicate the viewer. Everybody will interpret them differently. To me, that's, you know, another aspect of this show, which is very interactive in a way. Yeah, maybe some people will spontaneously start singing. I don't know. It's great to see these, you know, these fragments of sounds taken out of context, out of these comic books, and put them together into a new formation and a new composition. Because ultimately, even if these pieces are silent, they're compositions in my mind.
But Marclay's not just dealing in silence. Each weekend, there's a performance from well-known musicians and the London Sinfonietta. These are done in a large room lined with glasses of all shapes and sizes that Marclay discovered discarded on the street. On this particular Saturday afternoon, sound artist David Toop performs an improvised piece that uses water, glasses, guitars, a laptop and aquarium motors laid out around him in a circle. I ask him about the brief he was given.
The brief I was given was that I could use any of the glasses, but please don't break them. But to be able to use the glasses was great because I used to work with water a lot.
That works quite well with the whole liquid theme within the entire exhibition anyway. Was that also part of the decision?
Yeah, very much so. This whole aqueous theme, you know, the hydraulic pressing machine and the implications of drunkenness and afterwards, and even the paintings, which are in a way references to abstract expressionism, you know, the kind of that mix of comic book graphics with the idea of expressionism being something, abstract expressionism being something very physical, you know, the liquidity of paint thrown onto a canvas. So all of those things were in my mind.
And were you thinking about the different sounds that Christian's put on the wall as well? Because I was thinking when I was watching your performance that a lot of the sounds that I heard were sounds that I'd read on the walls in other parts of the exhibition.
I think that's a very nice connection to make an association between these graphic representations of dramatic sounds and what I was doing, but that wasn't at all conscious. I think one of the beauties of this kind of situation is that everybody can make connections for themselves.
But the performance doesn't end at David. In another room, where people are peering at sheet music through the bottom of a glass, there's an enormous shipping container housing a portable vinyl press.
I like to implicate the viewers and to get them engaged. The same with the performance space. You never know what's going to happen there. But I wanted to show the whole process from performance to document to a record. So one can follow a performance and then see how a few days later that performance will be printed on vinyl. We're also making the record covers there in the gallery.
All the elements of the factory are visible to the public, which is something that Christian really wanted people to be able to see. He wanted them to see the process of a record being made. He's fascinated by process. And a lot of people buy records, but they don't get to see how they're made.
That's Sean Bidder, creative director of the Vinyl Factory, the UK's largest vinyl pressing plant, who are known for their work with famous musicians and sound artists. They worked with Christian Marclay to produce the first portable press.
The difficulty for us, or the challenge for us, if you like, really, is that the hand press itself is reasonably small and relatively easy to operate, but it requires all the other elements that a normal factory requires to actually power it. So it requires a boiler, it requires a flume, it requires pipework. And these elements are normally housed in a very kind of safe environment, a factory where the public aren't given access. So we had to contain those. We had to come up with a way of containing those. So we decided that we would put this vinyl factory press into a shipping container. So that would house all the elements of the press itself. And then we would actually install that in Whitecube.
The fluidity of the process from recording to product is perhaps another play on the liquid theme in this immersive exhibition, which has drawn a captivated audience. David Toop again.
I mean, that's one of the great things an audience can do. You know, it can just take a completely subjective approach and be affected in some way by the nature of the exhibition and the nature of this performance and how they fit together, or don't.
Christian Marclay's exhibition is on now and runs at Whitecube until the 12th of April. Keep an eye out for performer announcements over the next week. Performances will take place at weekends and the records will be pressed on Thursdays and Fridays. For Monaco in London, I'm Holly Fisher.
Thanks, Holly. After the break, we'll be recapping last week's Sundance Film Festival with Variety's Peter de Bruges, no less. Stay tuned.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
You're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, now to the snowy hills of Utah, where the Sundance Film Festival has just wrapped up. Normally a byword for the best of American indie filmmaking, what sort of year did the festival have when we hear that US cinema audiences are dwindling and we seem to exist in the silver screen universe of sequels and superheroes only? To get a handle on the standout films as well as the all-important distribution deals done at the festival, I spoke to Variety's Peter DeBruges.
This is always a great place, I think, in American cinema to just catch up with the movies that don't feel like they're cookie cutter repeats of the things that you're getting every Friday, you know, in big cineplexes. You know, I've been spending the last year living abroad, actually. I'm based in Paris, and I've really realized how much I miss the kind of movies that Sundance represents. This is the kind of place where last year a movie like Boyhood or Whiplash, you know, was born into the world. And here there have been some really exciting new films. My favorites have been a film called Me and Earl and the Dying Girl that sounds on the surface like it would be really depressing. It's about a high school student who sort of reluctantly befriends this girl from his class who's been diagnosed with leukemia. And instead of being just a downer, this movie is multiple laughs a minute for the first 90 minutes of its running time. And then it takes a really well-deserved turn into more serious and ultimately, you know, sad territory. That movie's been great. There have been, you know, some others in competition like Diary of a Teenage Girl, which this festival is famous for sort of serving up all these coming-of-age stories. This one does it from a female point of view, where there's kind of some really edgy sexual exploration there. This teenage girl is basically hooking up with her mom's boyfriend, a kind of dumpy young lady who realizes that she has a lot more sort of pull or power with her kind of newly developing sexuality. That's kind of a subject matter that you don't see the Hollywood studios going anywhere near. And here it's done in a way that's funny and you know, kind of awkward and really kind of moving ultimately as well.
You're based in Paris, Peter. I guess this is the stuff of European cinema. French cinema doesn't shy away from these things. The taboos are looser, if they exist at all, in terms of European cinema, especially European art house cinema. What have the audience reactions in Sundance been like? Clearly, it's an international audience, but there's obviously a lot of American audiences there and buyers too. Do laughs or awkward intakes of breath equal acquisitions, I wonder?
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting about Sundance is while the festival is crowded with industry types, and these are cynical and kind of jaded people, whether we're talking about, you know, film critics who have a very high bar, or the, you know, acquisitions people, the agents, the people who might be either buying movies to release in theaters or looking for talent to represent in future projects, you know. The majority of the Sundance audience is just plain old folk, either, you know, Americans who love movies enough that they make the pilgrimage every year to sort of like this remote ski mountain town, or I guess you could call them locals. They're, you know, less than an hour away in Salt Lake City and just sort of normal moviegoers from who live in Utah who are looking for something a little bit more exciting than what they get every given week. I try and go to the public screenings because I want to see movies with that audience to get a sense of what their reaction will be. If you get a standing ovation at Sundance the way Me and Earl and the Dying Girl did, that is a pretty good indicator that that movie's commercial. Initially, there was so much heat around it after that first screening. There were rumors that it was the highest sale ever of a Sundance film. The reality has cooled a little bit, and we now know that Fox Searchlight, who released Little Miss Sunshine, you know, a few years back and paid the record for that film, has only paid $6 million here, but they've also sort of thrown in a chunk of what the movie will earn at the box office. So it could end up being, at the end of the day, that, you know, the most anyone makes off of a Sundance movie, filmmaker side, you know.
We've run stories in Monocle magazine back in the day about a day in the life of a seller of a film, actually, at Sundance, and these kind of all-night parties, which are kind of turn into kind of buying frenzies where people are racing from hotel room to hotel room with kind of parcels of cash, or certainly with like errands and messages. Is this what it's like, or have things changed in the modern age, in the digital age? Are people just, you know, texting each other figures? Is that how things are done, or is it all done kind of over drinks in the bar and over, we'd presume, a bottle of pop in a champagne room?
You know, I wish I sort of had a window into that sort of excitement, because it's clear that this is a year when there's, you know, a lot of competition for these most popular movies. as a film critic, I'm sort of experiencing this differently. I'm there in the room when I see the movies, and then I go back and I hunker down behind a, you know, a laptop, and I try and, you know, put together as eloquently as possible an impression as quickly as I can. And I miss out, I think, on what's going on at the parties or sort of like, you know, at the phone calls and such. I think there's still a lot of action there, but it's probably not as dramatic as it was in the, you know, sort of down and dirty pictures days that was described by Peter Biskind in his book about, you know, Sundance and the Weinstein heyday.
Well, that's very diligent of you, Peter. We're glad that Variety's man on the ground has got his nose pressed to the laptop rather than the party circuit, I'm sure. But just finally, I mean, you know, we can't talk about it without talking about the changing platforms, the way people enjoy films. The American box office was down 5% last year. It's perhaps not necessarily the job of Sundance to boost up those ticket sales, but maybe to level the playing field of the kind of films that more people see, maybe, and introducing people to a bit more of an art house sentiment. How would you describe this year? Is it a vintage year? Does it feel very Sundance and indie? Does it feel optimistic? What kind of year has it been generally?
But let's just remember that it's possible to be blinded by the excitement, and that's a whole other challenge to try and find an angle where you can sell these movies to a normal audience, because they're not just sort of the same genres, the same templates as the movies that Hollywood is producing. You have to be really careful, hands-on, kind of position these films in a way that audiences understand that they're getting something special. On the filmmaking side, there's a lot to be excited about. I think there's just incredible diversity here. And I mean that in terms of there are white people making films in which not all the characters are white. For once, I mean, maybe I'm exaggerating there, but in the sense that you've got colorblind casting, you know, this year Amazon announced that they would be producing a number of original films, and they also are acquiring here at Sundance. What is Amazon going to do with the movie? We don't entirely know, you know, but Transparent has shown that they're doing with television something that's unlike anything that the networks have done.
That was Variety Magazine's Peter DeBruge speaking to us from the Sundance Film Festival in snowy Utah. Coming up in the second half of the show, we'll meet comedian Nick Mohammed as he gears up for a farcical spell at London's Soho Theatre, and we'll pay a visit to a veritable convocation of clowns at the Joseph Grimaldi Memorial Service. He was the king of the clowns, see? That's all to come here on Culture on Monocle 24. In a moment, we're going to hear from Brad Barr, lead singer of Amadori House session band this week, the Barr Brothers. But first, here they are performing Even the Darkness Has Arms.
I was holding my breath on the tightrope walk. I slipped into the moon glow, saying, "Oh, my children, follow me. Maybe it's time to go. You can be chrome when you're wet, you can be wise when you're blue. And baby, if I had, then I have for you." Rapping the jury to keep me in jail, singing tea for the Tillerman. And although I lie fantastically, I swore an oath of my history. It's a miracle I can see. You can be wrong when you're right, even when you're right on cue. And if I die tonight, then I die for you. Calling the news, they call me son, great grandson or grandson, great uncles, aunts, and relatives. They judge what I've done. Gonna make it right by you, even if it's all I do. If it's all I do, then I do for you. People raise a whole lot of hell about the water and the windmill. And although I step chaotically, it hurts no one but me. Even the darkness has on. But they ain't got you. And maybe I have it, and I have you too. And light in the window to pass the night through. Maybe it's so uncertain, what can I do? Keeping it on, keeping it on. And I know I like it, but what does that prove? So much I worry, I don't know how to love you.
alpine woman that my passion wore. At the shoreline, where's the tide? Maybe the water went dry. Keeping an eye on you, with an eye on you, we could drown and meet soon. People raise a whole lot of hell about the water and the windmill. And although I stabbed the audit, swore an oath at my history, it's a miracle I can see. Even the darkness has arms, but they ain't got you. Baby, I have it, and I have you too. And a light in the winter to pass the night through. Maybe so uncertain, what can I do? Keeping it on, keeping it on. And I know I like it, but what does that prove? Sometimes I worry I don't know how to love you.
Well, Brad, congratulations on a fantastic record, Sleeping Operator. And it makes for a great session. I mean, I know you took the album to bits a little bit to do our session. You're kind of doing different size venues. Is that a bit of a voyage of discovery for you guys?
It certainly is. It's been kind of a testament to the songs and the musicians that we've been playing with. The band has been sort of expanding and contracting since we recorded the songs. So it's a learning process, figuring out how to do them live. It's been challenging because it's been a lot of rehearsing back home. The minute you get it dialed in, you know, someone else kind of comes on board and you get them up to speed. But we're lucky in Montreal to have a lot of good musicians and a lot of people who are willing to jump on the road with us and good friends.
Your percussionist had a pretty instrument of the day, although yeah. Your harpist, Sarah, I mean, you know, harpist alone is a great thing to be.
Yeah.
That's a pretty impressive thing to see. And the double bass always looks great. But your percussionist had a sort of pineapple-shaped... He called it the growth.
The growth.
it's a bit horrible. That's an amazing thing. He's got an array of stuff in his arsenal, right?
I think they're kind of giant seed pods with little ball bearings inside that he ties onto his ankle. Little shaker there.
It's got a good pagan look to it.
It does. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Do you have to sort of resist the temptation to take your foot off the gas pedal when it comes to overdubbing and messing?
Yeah. It's about finding that balance. Luckily, you know, Andrew and I are kind of working together on most of the stuff. You know, we'd play with the band live in the studio and what it needs versus what you might want to throw on top of that thing. Try and get as close to it live and then honing in on stuff. And like a song like Love Ain't Enough, we did get carried away on that. I mean, just adding layers of pulsing stuff. And
yeah, a lot of reviews of Sleeping Operator have sort of said, oh, it's great because, you know, it's got this maybe slightly traditional, it's got the folk rock sound, but you've incorporated the African rhythms in it and all the rest of it. You name check Salif Keita. Did those African rhythms come from trips or sort of scouring record collections or a bit of both?
When we were growing up in Providence, Rhode Island, our father's a dentist. And Brown University, which is located in Providence, they started bringing over a couple of people from Mali to teach drum and dance classes. And one guy in particular, he came over, he needed a dentist, and he went to see my father. And my father fixed his teeth and did a great job and fixed up a couple of his friends. And these guys were so grateful, but they didn't have a ton of money to pay my dad his usual rate, so they offered to exchange drum lessons. I guess somehow they got talking that his sons were musicians, and they traded us music lessons for dental care. And that's how we got to know the music and the people. This is when we were maybe 10, 11, 12 years old.
It's a beautiful thing. And I'm glad that the sort of African rhythms on your record come from Mali's slightly wanting dental system. That's always a good tale. And I can't wait for the new record called Lie Back, You Won't Feel a Thing. For the time being, Brad from the Bar Brothers, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24, where now we're going to have a good old laugh at Mohammed. Nick Mohammed is a British comedian and a former Cambridge footlight with a neat line in characters, most notably that of Mr. Swallow, a pooterish, small-minded and very, very funny creation that in a couple of weeks will be unleashed on London's Soho Theatre. Nick Mohammed, as Mr. Swallow, will be trying to stage a musical version of Dracula. It won't go well. In fact, it's not meant to at all because it's a farce. Here is Nick Mohammed with the Jollies.
Mr. Swallow is a character that I've done over the past sort of 10 years on the circuit and up in Edinburgh and on Radio 4. It's a character that's kind of quite close to my heart. It was initially based on an impression of a teacher from school, a she, so it kind of comes across quite sort of camp, but it is androgynous in some respects. It's just, yeah. It's not, there's no innuendo in it. It's just because I'm effectively playing a woman, but acting like a man. And, you know, he's quite northern and quite sort of dismissive, and that's a little flavour of his voice. But he is...
he's a bit nasal.
He's quite nasal and just annoyed at lots of things. And the show is about him trying to put on his own musical of Dracula, where he plays Dracula, but the show's not ready, so you're effectively seeing the dress rehearsal of it, so it's kind of an out-and-out sort of farce.
Oh, I like it. So it's a bit of peering behind the... A bit of Brechtian theatre going on there.
Just stolen lots of popular ideas. And...
That's all right. One of them being Dracula.
Exactly,
which I think people might have heard before.
Yeah, it was actually quite useful doing Dracula just because everyone knows the story of Dracula already, so you didn't really need to bother with any exposition.
Okay, so that's the thing. You have to take such a well-known story, a well-worn story, that people can people know what's going right and people know what's going wrong in the farce.
Partly because in Edinburgh you only get sort of 55 minutes to do the show anyway, so there was no way it could be any longer to try and do a whole musical and tell the story of Dracula and to do a whole kind of behind the scenes sort of thing as well. It was always going to be a bit of a squash, so it was good choosing a well-known story.
What's it like rehearsing a thing like this, a show like this, where there are moments of purposeful crapness and then it has to swing into, as you say, actually some pretty good, genuinely funny or genuinely sort of melodramatic bits?
I think it's that thing of you almost, like, if you want to look as if you're playing the piano badly, you have to actually be able to play the piano well. Because I think you have to kind of go there first and then kind of sort of step back, or at least kind of from a script point of view, you have to kind of think, well, what would be the best way of telling this story? What would they sort of strive to do? And then sort of think, well, then how could it go wrong? So you kind of, I suppose, aim to do the thing that it would be if it has been done for real and done properly, and then kind of undermine it. And so you kind of go through a little bit of a process. But it's fun. It's fun doing it. And you often then find that there's then more things that you can poke fun of as soon as you start kind of poking fun at a situation, or something's gone wrong, or someone's mic's not on, or something like that. You can suddenly find a lot more kind of things. You can sort of start to mine it then.
And how much of that is written, and how much of that happens just through rehearsal and kind of finding what's funny with everybody else? I mean, how big is the team of actors?
So there's only another three cast on top of me. So there's only a cast of four, and then we've got a five-piece band. And there's quite a, you know, certainly from... previous Edinburgh experiences, I mean, quite a big production teaming, because we sort of did it as if it was a musical. So there's a choreographer, a composer, you know, there's an MD, there's lots of different people who we could also interact with as part of the show, because, you know, they've got a job to do which they're either not doing right or so on. But actually the script was very much, it was quite a sort of a heavily written script in the first instance, and then sort of through Edinburgh we would kind of tweak little bits because we were anticipating sort of doing it again in London and stuff. But I mean, pretty much now it's sort of written. Occasionally I'll sort of go off piste a bit, but much to the distress of the other actors, and
stop doing it. We want you on a piece of elastic.
Yeah,
let's have it then. What would Mr. Swallow make of the show in which he stars?
He'd probably just be annoyed that it's doing quite well, because it means he's got to sort of do it every night for another month, basically.
So what is he like? Is he sort of a pooterish character?
It was based on I shouldn't give too much away in case she finds out, but it was based on an English teacher.
Okay.
I mean, I think she might have passed away, which is quite...
That's all right. It's
an homage.
It's easier for you.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, I don't think she has. I mean, she adored the sound of her own voice, so all the lessons were basically about her. She always had a go at us. I mean, I remember she made every lesson, she was like, right, we're going to do a debate now. And it was like, we're meant to be doing English literature, but she sort of turned it into sort of like this big forum where she could sort of put forward her views. And I remember we had to debate capital punishment, and we were...
That's a school classic, isn't it? Fox hunting and capital punishment.
It's a school classic. Yeah. She, the start of the lesson, she handed us an A3 printout of Myra Hindley's face. That was the starting point. I mean, she was pretty bold with her methods of teaching.
Right.
And we were obviously quite shocked. And anyone who disagreed with, I mean, she believed that, you know, everyone should be put to death, basically, whatever crime. And and anyone who disagreed, she would sort of pretty much blame the pupil that they were agreeing with this cold-hearted... Sorry, it's gone very dark.
Well, it has, but then we are discussing Mr. Swallow as Dracula.
Yeah, that's
it's true. All right. You know, we can come back. Exactly. Yeah. Come back.
Yeah,
that's why you're on a piece of elastic.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank God for that.
Yeah.
And another thing, I do have a little page of buzzwords written down. The next buzzword is Ridley Scott.
Oh yeah,
your star. Tell us about this. I mean, this is an exciting and interesting bit of casting. Tell us what are you doing?
Well, it kind of is weird. Oddly, it came off the back of doing the musical, because the casting director had come and seen it. And then I kind of got seen for this, I mean, to be fair, quite straight role in Ridley Scott's next film, which is The Martian, which is an Andy Weir novel, based on an Andy Weir novel, about an astronaut. It's sort of set about 3-4 years in the future, where there's a mission to Mars and they come back, but they've actually left someone there who they thought died on Mars, but is not. And that guy is Matt Damon. And I play one of the guys trying, sort of on Earth, trying to bring him back. And so it was an American kind of character. I mean, it wasn't even a character, just an American accent I was doing. But it's quite sort of dry. But it was, I mean, I was as surprised as everyone has been that I got the part.
And I like that, though.
And yeah, I mean, I was delighted to do it. I mean, it's quite surreal because it's unlike, you know, I've never done a 3D IMAX blockbuster, obviously. used to doing the circuit and stuff.
Yeah.
But it was really fun. And he is obviously iconic. And they film really quick and... I tried to really kind of focus and like treat it as like a proper acting job because I just didn't want to mess up. I was so scared of kind of getting something wrong. I think if I was more relaxed, I would probably sort of have been a bit more kind of jokey or sort of think, oh, how could that be sort of funny? But actually, I was just quite terrified throughout the whole thing.
I like it. Well, you know how the best way to get a man back from Mars?
Yeah.
Just put him on a piece of elastic.
Yeah, true. True. Don't know why they didn't.
I don't know why they didn't think of that. I suppose that would be a massive kind of a great dramatic leitmotif.
Actually, it does...
it's all right. He's on a piece of elastic.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. You could. That could be in your improv.
Yes, that's true.
Can you say that in an American accent, though?
It's fine. When I was on Mars, I just attached him to a piece of elastic. Is that what you said? Elastic.
Something
elastic.
Like
I mean, it's a bit rough around the edges.
It's a bit rough. We can work through that.
Yeah, it'll pass.
Nick Mohammed is Mr. Swallow. Mr.
Mm-hmm.
Swallow is Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
That is happening at the Soho Theatre. Starting from the 9th of February.
From the 9th until the end of February, yeah.
Perfect. Well, get your tickets. Google that place. Google Nick Mohammed and find out all about it. And for the time being, thank you very much indeed for coming on The Culture Show. You're listening to Culture on Monocle 24. On the first Sunday of each February, for over half a century, clowns from all over the world make a pilgrimage to Dalston in East London to attend the annual Clowns Church service. They come to commemorate the grandfather of British clowning, Joseph Grimaldi, as well as members of the international clown community who have passed away that year. Monocle's Henry Reece Sheridan went along to the All Saints Church to find out how you celebrate the life of a harlequin.
A brisk walk to church may not be an unusual activity for a cold Sunday morning in February, but the service I'm attending today promises to be slightly more colourful than normal. This is Joseph Grimaldi's annual memorial service. I was greeted at the church hall by a group of excited clowns gearing up for the proceedings and took the chance to meet a few members of the congregation.
My name's Bubbles. I'm a mathematical clown. I've managed to come almost every year since 2006, which is when I joined Clowns International, because I only discovered I was a clown in 2005.
Could you expand on that? What do you mean by you only discovered you were a clown?
Well, there's this woman called Caroline that occupies this body once in a while. And she discovered Bubbles inside her when she was 42 years old.
And what does it take to be a clown? Is there some kind of official process that you need to go through in order to be able to call yourself a clown?
Within Clowns International, there are two grades. There's like an apprentice clown or a provisional clown, and then once you've been witnessed performing and it's decided that you're at a certain level, then you become a full clown as a member. But in terms of what's in your heart, a clown, in my opinion, is born. It's something that you discover, and yes, you gain skills, but it's something that you just are. And you can tell the difference between a children's entertainer and a clown just from that connection.
Two, three, four.
Despite having been made aware of the distinction by Bubbles, I made the faux pas of mistaking a non-clown for a clown. After an awkward moment, I determined to get his perspective on the issue.
Hello, I'm Steve. I'm a children's entertainer, not clown. Friend of clown, sympathetic to the cause.
Could you describe your appearance for us, please?
Me? I'm 6'2". I'm wearing a bright green suit with a red waistcoat and green hair and a red top hat.
And your companion?
This monk's. He's got his casual top, sunglasses. He's about a one-foot monkey. He's a little shy, doesn't speak much.
Now, as you mentioned at the beginning, you're not in fact a clown. What are you?
I'm a children's entertainer and balloon artist. There's a very subtle difference, especially in the face mainly.
Could you explain that difference? Specifically, what are all the differences between you and the clown?
Clowns are sort of two persona. They have their normal life where they're very boring people, then the clown persona where they're outrageous, claims you fall over a lot. I'm a children's entertainer. I don't do the falling over, but I go out as me. So I'm sometimes a tall man, green suit with a monkey. Sometimes I don't wear the suit. So it's just exaggerating me. I'm me all the time, whereas a clown becomes themselves when they perform.
That's fascinating. Do you have aspirations to be a clown?
No, I used to find clowns quite scary, actually. I admire the art. It's very skilled and it's very open, but no, I've never wanted to be a clown.
Once things settle down, the names of the clowns who have passed away since the last service are read out. I'm eager to talk to a member of the clergy involved in the event. I managed to track down Vicar Simon Buckley, who performed in the puppet show.
I've been taking the sermon slot, and so preaching in this service for Grimaldi, the famous clown's anniversary, and the annual clown service, and I was preaching using puppets to tell the parable of the prodigal son. It's the clowns clearly value it as an opportunity to come together, and Rose Hudson-Wilkin, who led the service, said very clearly at the beginning, you know, this is an act of worship, because everything that we say within it is orientated towards God. So in some respects, this is not unlike any other act of worship, any other church service, but it is ultimately a service, not a concert.
The service struck a nice balance between the sombre and the silly, and was a fitting tribute to both Grimaldi and those he has inspired. For Monocle, in London, I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan.
Thanks, Henry, and that brings us to the end of this week's show. Join us again next time, though, where we'll meet artist John Gerard, and we'll have a live session from Milwaukee's finest Field Report. You've been tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Holly Fisher. My field report of her is 10 out of 10. Time for one final song, though, from this week's Midori House session. Here's those brilliant Bar Brothers with Come in the Water. Thanks, as ever, for tuning in.
Come in the water. There ain't nobody else here. Feel it still when the planes are coming. I just wanna lie here. Left our homes, left our friends, left the wombs we live in, spread out along the road. I've been weak when my Lord was calling. Don't you know the water will take our load? On the day that you were born, legions laid down their arms. Legions left for your throne. Tell me I'm wrong. Is the face in the water unmistakable? Lacks the color of the sea when it's free from the light of the sun. Your crystal ball. And the children are asleep with their heads on the butt of a gun. You put up a wall, keep the dark ones out and the good ones in. You fight a battle on your knees till the seed swallows everyone. Is there somewhere you have to go? But keep a lantern open.
case you lose your way in the cold. On the day that you were born, legions lay down their arms. On the day they found you out, left no shadow of a doubt.
The sea swallows everyone.